Joseph Pieper, In Tune with the World, Chapter 3. Perhaps because we are so allergic to big words, we hesitate to speak of a festival as a day of rejoicing. All the same, we should have to concur if someone chose to understate a little and called it, at the least, a joyous affair. On a festival day, people enjoy themselves. Even one who terms it quite a trick to find such people is merely saying that it has become difficult and rare to celebrate a festival festively. But no one denies that it should be, by its nature, a day of rejoicing. An early Christian Greek went so far as to say, "Festivity is joy and nothing else." Now it is the nature of joy to be a secondary phenomenon. No one can rejoice absolutely for joy's sake alone. To be sure, it is foolish to ask a man why he wants to rejoice. To that extent, joy is an end in itself. Nevertheless, the longing for joy is nothing but the desire to have a reason and pretext for joy. This reason, to the extent that it actually exists, precedes joy and is different from it. The reason comes first, the joy comes second. But the reason for joy, although it may be encountered in 1,000 concrete forms, is always the same. Possessing or receiving what one loves, whether actually in the present, hoped for in the future, or remembered in the past. Joy is an expression of love. One who loves nothing and nobody cannot possibly rejoice, no matter how desperately he craves joy. Joy is the response of a lover receiving what he loves. True as it is that a real festival cannot be conceived without joy, it is no less true that first there must be a substantial reason for joy, which might also be called the festive occasion. Strictly speaking, it is not enough for this reason to exist objectively. Men must also accept and acknowledge it as a reason for joy. They must experience it themselves as a receiving of something they love. An odd sort of objectivity has sometimes been attributed to festivals, as though they could exist even without people. "It is Easter, even where nobody celebrates it." That's a quotation. It seems to me that such a notion is illusory, as long as we are speaking of festivals as a human reality. The inner structure of real festivity has been stated in the clearest and tersest possible fashion by Chrysostom. "Ubi caritas gaudet, ibi est festivitas." Where love rejoices, there is festivity. Now, what sort of reason underlies festal joy, and therefore festivity itself? Plant a flower-decked pole in the middle of an open place, call the people together, and you have a fete. That's a quotation there, too. Everyone, one would think, sees that that is not enough. But I did not invent the sentence as an example of naive simplification. It was written by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It is an almost equally hopeless simplification to imagine that mere ideas can be the occasion for real festivals. Something more is needed, something of another order. The celebrant himself must have shared in a distinctly real experience. When Easter is declared a festival of immortality, it is scarcely surprising that no response is forthcoming, not to speak of such fantastic proposals as those of Auguste Comte, whose reformed calendar established festivals of humanity, paternity, and even domesticity. I'd like to see that. Not even the idea of freedom can inspire people with a spirit of festivity, though the celebration of liberation might, assuming that the event, though possibly belonging to the distant past, still has compelling contemporary force. Memorial days are not in themselves festival days. Strictly speaking, the past cannot be celebrated festively unless the celebrant community still draws glory and exaltation from that past, not merely as reflected history, but by virtue of a historical reality still operative in the present. If the incarnation of God is no longer understood as an event that directly concerns the present lives of men, it becomes impossible, even absurd, to celebrate Christmas festively. Joseph Andreas Jungmann has recently suggested that festivals as an institution have already become derivative, whereas the prototypical form of festival, he says prototypal, but I'm saying prototypical, whereas the prototypical form of festival still takes place where a specific event, such as birth, marriage, or homecoming, is being directly celebrated. If the implication is that the specific event is the real reason of all celebrations, and also the highest rationale which a modern theory of festivals can provide, the thesis is not altogether convincing. We can and must pursue the inquiry further to ask, for example, on what grounds does a specific event become the occasion for festival and celebration? Can we festively celebrate the birth of a child if we hold with Jean-Paul Sartre's dictum, "It is absurd that we are born"? Anyone who is seriously convinced that, quote, "our whole existence is something that would be better not being," unquote, and that consequently life is not worth living, can no more celebrate the birth of his child than any other birthday, his own or anyone else's, a 50th or 60th or any other. No single specific event can become the occasion for festive celebrations unless what? Here is where we must be able to name the reason underlying all others. The reason why events such as birth, marriage, homecoming are felt as the receiving of something beloved, without which there can be neither joy nor festivity. Again we find Nietzsche expressing the crucial insight, one painfully brought home, it would seem, as the result of terrible inner trials, for he was as familiar with the despair of being unable to take enough joy in anything as with the, quote, "vast unbounded yea and amen saying," unquote. The formulation is to be found in his posthumous notes and reads, quote, "To have joy in anything, one must approve everything," unquote. Underlying all festive joy kindled by a specific circumstance, there has to be an absolutely universal affirmation extending to the world as a whole, to the reality of things and the existence of man himself. Naturally, this approval need not be a product of conscious reflection. It need not be formulated at all. Nevertheless, it remains the sole foundation for festivity, no matter what happens to be celebrated in concreto. And as the radical nature of negation deepens, and consequently as anything but ultimate arguments becomes ineffectual, it becomes more necessary to refer to this ultimate foundation. By ultimate foundation, I mean the conviction that the prime festive occasion, which alone can ultimately justify all celebration, really exists. That, to reduce it to the most concise phrase, at bottom, everything that is good, and it is good to exist. For man cannot have the experience of receiving what is loved unless the world and existence as a whole represent something good, and therefore beloved to him. Incidentally, there is a kind of confirmation of this from the other shore, as it were. Whenever we happen to feel heartfelt assent, to find that something specific is good, wonderful, glorious, rapturous, a drink of fresh water, or the precise functioning of a tool, or the colors of a landscape, or the charm of a loving gesture, a poem. Whenever that happens, our praise always reaches beyond the given object, if matters take their natural course. Our tribute always contains at least a smattering of affirmation of the world as a whole, so that the converse of the sentence we have just quoted is also valid, and again Nietzsche has formulated it. Quote, "If it be granted that we say yea to a single moment, then in doing so we have said yea not only to ourselves, but to all existence." Unquote. Need we bother to say how little such affirmation has to do with shallow optimism, let alone with smug approval of that which is? Such affirmation is not won by deliberately shutting one's eyes to the horrors in this world. Rather, it proves its seriousness by its confrontation with historical evil. The quality of this assent is such that we must attribute it even to martyrs, at the very moment, perhaps, that they perish under brutal assault. A theologian commenting on the Apocalypse has said that what distinguishes the Christian martyr is that he never utters a word against God's creation. In spite of everything, he finds the things that are very good. Therefore, in spite of everything, he remains capable of joy, and even, as far as it concerns him, of festivity. Whereas, on the other hand, whoever refuses assent to reality as a whole, no matter how well off he may be, is by that fact incapacitated for either joy or festivity. Festivity is impossible to the naysayer. The more money he has, and above all the more leisure, the more desperate is this impossibility to him. This is also true of the man who refuses to approve the fact of his own existence. Having fallen into that mysterious, ineffable despair from weakness of which Søren Kierkegaard has spoken, and which in the old moral philosophy went by the name of acedia, slothfulness of the heart. At issue is a refusal regarding the very heart and fountainhead of existence itself, because of the despair of not willing to be oneself, which makes man... At issue is a refusal regarding the very heart and fountainhead of existence itself, because of the despair of not willing to be oneself, which makes man unable to live with himself. He is driven out of his own house, into the hurly-burly of work and nothing else, into the fine-spun, exhausting game of sophistical phrase-mongering. Academia. Into incessant entertainment by empty stimulants. In short, into a no-man's land, which may be quite comfortably furnished, but which has no place for the serenity of intrinsically meaningful activity, for contemplation, and certainly not for festivity. Festivity lives on affirmation. Even celebrations for the dead, All Souls and Good Friday, can never be truly celebrated except on the basis of faith that all is well with the world and life as a whole. If there is no consolation, the idea of a funeral as a solemn act is self-contradictory. But consolation is a form of rejoicing, although the most silent of all. Just as catharsis, the purification of the soul and the witnessing of tragedy, is at bottom a joyful experience, the real locus of the tragic is not in those works of literature we term tragedies, but in man's historical reality. Consolation exists only on the premise that grief, sorrow, death are accepted, and therefore affirmed, as meaningful in spite of everything. I think David Bentley Hart would disagree with that. This is the point at which to correct the misconception which sometimes prevails, that the festive is also the cheerful. It is significant that, according to Greek myth, all great festivals had their origins in the celebration of funeral rites, and historians of religion have repeatedly pointed out that the ancient Roman festivals must not be considered simply as days of rejoicing. Naturally, for a festival to develop a broad and rich appeal, jesting, gaiety, and laughter cannot be excluded from it, nor even some riotousness and carnival. But a festival becomes true festivity only when man affirms the goodness of his existence by offering the response of joy. Can it be that this goodness is never revealed to us so brightly and powerfully as by the sudden shock of loss and death? This is an implication of Hölderlin's famous distich on Sophocles' Antigone. Viele versuchten umsonst, das Freudigste freudig zu sagen. Hier spricht endlich es mir, hier in der Trauer sich aus. Many endeavored in vain, joyfully to speak profoundest joy. Here at last, in the tragic, I see it expressed. And Trauer can be, I guess, sorrow too, so... Is it therefore so surprising that both the affirmation of life and its rejection should be hard to recognize, not only to the eye of the outsider, but possibly to one's own inner eye? When we look at the martyr, it is by no means plain that he is affirming the world in spite of everything. For, after all, he is not instantly recognizable as a martyr, but as a defendant, a convict, a ridiculous eccentric, but, above all, as one who has been silenced. Similarly, non-assent may also appear under a disguise. For example, it may be covered over by pleasure, agreeable enough in itself and springing from sheer vitality, in dancing, music, drinking, so that the rejection remains for a while hidden, even from the self. And that's why I think it's so difficult to say anything about Carnival is a really, really tricky thing. Carnival phenomena are really tricky when we're talking about festivity here. Precisely because the non-assent can be covered over by pleasure, as he says. Above all, this rejection may be concealed behind the facade of a more or less sham confidence in life. The jovial laughter of Sisyphus, who negates the gods and raises rocks, is deceptive, even in the sense that the deception may succeed, or, which would be infinitely harder, that he may deceive himself. Strictly speaking, however, it is insufficient to call affirmation of the world a mere prerequisite and premise for festivity. In fact, it is far more. It is the substance of festivity. Festivity, in its essential core, is nothing but the living out of this affirmation. To celebrate a festival means to live out, for some special occasion, and in an uncommon manner, the universal assent to the world as a whole. And he has that in italics, so I will read it again. To celebrate a festival means to live out, for some special occasion, and in an uncommon manner, the universal assent to the world as a whole. This statement harmonizes with the conclusions cultural and religious historians have drawn from their studies of the great typical festivals in ancient cultures and among primitive peoples. And because that assent to life, if it is there all the time, it becomes the wellspring for a thousand legitimate occasions for festivity. The immediate event may be equally the coming of spring or of a baby's first tooth. Consequently, we may properly speak of everlasting festival as existing at least in latent form. In fact, church liturgy recognizes only festival days, which by a strange and devious linguistic evolution has led to a change in the meaning of feria. Originally, the word meant festival, but now it is beginning to signify the festival celebrated on ordinary weekdays. So significant a philosopher and theologian as Origen contended that the naming of specific holy days was done only for the sake of the uninitiate and beginners who were not yet capable of celebrating the eternal festival. But it is still too early in our discussion to examine this phase of the matter. First of all, we must now state explicitly a conclusion toward which all our foregoing ideas have inexorably been led. To be sure, as I have found time and again, this statement is usually greeted with alarm and distrust, as though to voice it is somehow equivalent to launching an unfair surprise attack. Nevertheless, I see no legitimate way of avoiding it. It is absolutely compelling, both logically and existentially. The conclusion is divisible into several parts. It looks like there's actually three of them. First, there can be no more radical assent to the world than the praise of God, the lauding of the creator of this same world. One cannot conceive a more intense, more unconditional affirmation of being. If the heart of festivity consists in men's physically expressing their agreement with everything that is, then secondly, the ritual festival is the most festive form that festivity can possibly take. The other side of this coin is that, thirdly, there can be no deadlier, more ruthless destruction of festivity than refusal of ritual praise. Any such nay tramples out the spark from which the flickering flame of festivity might have been kindled anew. And that's the big question about, and that's the end of the chapter, but I'll just say that's the big question about Carnival. And especially the way so many of these, you know, historians and scholars of the Middle Ages are reading Carnival in that times as sort of fundamentally anti-ritualistic. And if that is the case, then I think we have to say that it's demonic Carnival, and it's not festivity, and it has nothing to do with the Carnival of the Gospel text, for example, Matthew's triumphant entry. This is really helping me to sort of point out how dangerous thinking about carnival phenomena is without thinking about precisely what Pieper's doing here, the theory or really theology of festivity. in which Carnival has to participate or make a decisive decision not to participate. The end.